This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for joining me and listening in. The showers are expected to continue throughout today and tomorrow, probably until tomorrow evening, with what feels like chilly temperatures now. Today the highs will only be in the upper 40s, although tomorrow on Saturday it's expected to get back up to 65. Sunday should be partly sunny, and look for a clear sky on Sunday night. We got a great show for you today, so let's get started. This week, the Ames Lab became 70 years old. Their actual birthday was on May 17th. The Ames Lab can be described as a major institution that's hiding in plain sight. Most of us know that there is the Ames Lab here at Iowa State University. But what exactly is the Ames Lab and what does it do? To find out, we had Adam Schwartz, the director of the Ames Lab, and Vitaly Pacharsky, a scientist and researcher, come into KHOI. Here's Adam Schwartz, giving us the national context for what the Ames Lab actually is as part of a system of 17 different federal facilities created by the American government for scientific research.
We are a mechanism by which science and technology and engineering can be accomplished for the good of the country. Through Iowa State University's oversight, we are what's called a federally funded research and development center. The Ames Laboratory is one of only 17 Department of Energy national laboratories in the entire country.
And by national laboratory, you mean a laboratory that belongs to the federal government?
Yeah. Basically, the federal government, in this case the Department of Energy, helps define the overall mission of the laboratory, accomplished by the contractor, Iowa State University.
So it's a collaboration between a federal interest and the local talent here at Iowa State. Is that a good way to describe it?
Local talent and national and global talent. We recruit scientists from all over the country and all over the world. We have a very international staff, which brings a significant amount of diversity, both in terms of cultural, but also in terms of scientific ideas.
Ames Lab greatly enhances the value of Iowa State University.
Oh, I like to think so. And it goes both ways. As contractor, Iowa State University has been absolutely fantastic in supporting the laboratory and helping us achieve our mission. Mm-hmm. The support that we get from the university administration, the collaborations we have with the College of Engineering, College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, the deans, the department chairs, the faculty, postdocs and students are what make Ames Laboratory who we are. Having a national laboratory housed in Ames is really something special. For most of the year, there's happy, smiling, hopeful students spewing all over the hallways. It's really a wonderful culture.
Where are other national laboratories located?
There are a few that sit in the vicinity of universities, like SLAC, Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, sits up the hill from Stanford. Stanford's their contractor. Princeton Plasma Physics Laboratory sits on really an island that might be a mile from campus, not quite a mile from campus. Other laboratories sit out in the middle of nowhere. Los Alamos National Laboratory, for example, it was placed there in the development of the Manhattan Project because of its isolation.
Is there one in Berkeley?
There is one in Berkeley.
It's up on the hill
Berkeley
there, right?
Lab sits up on the hill, and it turns out that hill is quite a barrier to getting the faculty to walk up that hill.
Yeah, it's a beautiful hill.
It is a beautiful hill.
Are they all distinctly different in what they specialize?
There are different offices within the Department of Energy. For example, there's an office of nuclear energy. They have a laboratory that sits in Idaho. There's an applied energy office that has a laboratory in Golden, Colorado. The nuclear weapons program has three laboratories, Los Alamos, Lawrence Livermore Lab, and Sandia National Laboratories. Ames Laboratory's science focuses on condensed matter physics, material science and engineering, and chemistry. So that is our core expertise. It has been our core expertise since virtually 70 years ago when Frank Spedding and team started purifying uranium for the Manhattan Project. The Office of Science, of which Ames Laboratory is one of those laboratories. Office of Science has 10 laboratories total. Some of them are multi-program. So they do materials like Ames Laboratory, but they also do a lot of work for fossil energy. They do cybersecurity. They might do nuclear non-proliferation. These are multi-program labs, incredible breadth in their scope. For example, Oak Ridge National Laboratory, the largest of the multi-program Office of Science labs, has programs that span pretty much everything that impacts U.S. energy policy and energy execution. So it's a wide variety.
How big or small of a role do these 17 laboratories play? What is their impact on the scientific community in the United States and the world?
It's massive. The national laboratories have a huge contribution in the number of scientific publications on the basic science side every year. National laboratories dominate in the number of awards that are given out. We are the smallest of the national labs. Of those 17, we're the only one that actually sits on the campus of a university.
So do you see it as an asset?
Tremendous asset, absolutely. We're actually the smallest lab by far. But our reach and our breadth is significantly enhanced because of the university. We don't have particular expertise on staff. Most likely we can find that in one of the departments on campus. It's a tremendous advantage. It also helps us keep our costs down. The university provides a library. The university provides cafeterias. It provides road services, landscaping, all these things that other national laboratories have to pay for in one form or another. We don't have to worry about that.
Does the Ames Lab own its buildings?
That's a great question. The federal government built all of the Ames Laboratory buildings. We now have 13 of them. As you drive up University, then on to Pamel, you pass by Wilhelm Hall, Spedding Hall, TASSEP, which is our Technical and Administrative Services facility, and Metals Development. Across the parking lot to the north, we have some warehouses, a paint and air conditioning shop. And then last year, we completed and moved into our sensitive instrument facility, our first new research building in more than 50 years that's designed to house very sensitive, as the name implies, electron beam characterization equipment. Allows us to look at the inside of metals and alloys and ceramics and polymers with incredibly high resolution. And that is sited out at the Applied Sciences Complex, about a mile and a half from the main buildings.
It's out on Ontario Road,
yes,
right?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. And all of those buildings, those are indeed federal buildings. We also have an excellent agreement with the university where there are university professors who do research for Ames Laboratory. They have laboratories in Ames Laboratory buildings, and then a few of our staff have space in university buildings.
So Iowa State helps with staff costs as well.
Iowa State University funds approximately 80 joint faculty.
Is the Ames Lab an attraction for scientists?
Yeah. In the areas that we are really good at, chemistry, physics, material science, it absolutely is a huge attractor. I can think of a handful of faculty members who joined recently who probably would not have come to Iowa State University if it weren't for the connection with Ames Laboratory. Those departments, physics, chemistry, materials, are particularly strong because of the association and the fact that Ames Laboratory sits on the campus.
This is Local Talk, and I'm Ursula Rudenberg, speaking with Adam Schwartz, the director of the Ames Lab, and Vitaly Pecharsky, scientific researcher at the Ames Lab and professor at Iowa State University. And the Ames Lab is celebrating its 70th anniversary this week. It turned 70 years old on May 17th. Mr. Schwartz and Mr. Pecharsky are explaining the research that occurs at the Ames Lab and what the purpose of this federal facility here at Iowa State University is.
The physics that we do is focused on materials. Condensed matter physics, condensed means solid or liquid, not gas, not plasma, not high energy physics, not astrophysics, solid. And for the most part, it's focused on the synthesis or the creation of new materials. And again, that expertise goes all the way back 70 plus years when the Manhattan Project came to Iowa State College, as it was known at the time, and asked if scientists here, professors here, would be able to purify uranium. And the reason why they did that is because Frank Spedding was
professor at Iowa State.
He was a professor of chemistry at Iowa State, internationally recognized for his expertise in rare earth elements. At the time, there was virtually no expertise in the actinides, in uranium. And that is what the Manhattan Project needed. It needed highly pure uranium in order to, at a later stage, enrich that in order to make the bombs that they were making.
Was his expertise that attracted the federal government to Iowa State?
That's right. He was the world expert in purification of these rare earths. So the Manhattan Project came to Ames and came to Frank Spedding and basically said, do you think you can purify uranium? And I wasn't there at the time, but I imagine he just shrugged his shoulders and said, oh, I'll give it a try. And he and his team went on to purify about a third of the uranium used in the first nuclear chain reaction at the Chicago pile. And then throughout the Manhattan Project, Frank Spedding and his team, Harley Wilhelm, went on to purify about 2 million pounds of uranium that was ultimately enriched and used for the weapons program. That expertise resulted in the awarding of the Army-Navy E flag.
This is a military award?
It is a military award. Mm-hmm. Usually it's given for production, so it was given off to industry. I believe Iowa State College is the only university to ever have received this incredibly prestigious award. And a few years later, after World War II ended, in 1947, Ames Laboratory became a national laboratory.
Presumably, Professor Spedding was a relatively adept administrator as well, that he was able to transform the activity that they did with the uranium into an actual institution here at Iowa State.
I imagine he was an excellent administrator as well as a phenomenal chemist. He was the first laboratory director for 20 years. A very, 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 very long time.
Mm-hmm.
So not only was he a great scientist, but he was a great leader as well.
He was able to convert that expertise into institutional value for Iowa State.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And over the 20 years that he was the laboratory director, he continued his own research in the rare earth materials, expanded that out. And over the period from 1947 until about now, Ames Laboratory became world leaders in rare earth science. We also have incredible expertise based on that in magnetism, in superconductivity, on the chemistry side, in developing new or hybrid catalysts for things like biodiesel production. We have expertise in critical materials. Critical materials are anything that you don't have enough of, and Ames Laboratory, because of its materials focus for 70 years, has developed truly unique expertise within the complex and is able to lead large programs in magnetism, superconductivity, and critical materials. And I'd be happy to talk about those.
Okay. Yeah, let's do that. But before we do that, what is a rare earth material? What is that?
Rare earth elements, they sit down there relatively far on the periodic table. They have complex chemistry and complex physics due to their electronic structure. A rare earth material is the series of elements on the periodic table where you have the emergence of F electrons. So I won't go into a chemistry.
F electrons. Okay.
So if you pull up your chemistry book from a few years ago, you might remember that as you go down and across the periodic table, you're adding more and more electrons. Ultimately, you get to the F shell electrons. And it's those F electrons that provide some of the most interesting physics in chemistry anywhere on the periodic table.
Hmm.
By the time you get down to the rare earths, the physical and chemical behavior becomes very, very complex and very interesting.
So uranium is a rare earth?
Uranium sits down one row below the rare earths.
So what is a rare earth that we would recognize?
Oh, the common names like neodymium and dysprosium and europium and terbium, those common names you use all the time. And it turns out that 70 years ago, the rare earths had some but relatively limited technological uses. Now the rare earths are in every single piece of electronic equipment that you see, you touch, you use.
Are these things you find in nature? Or?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in sense, rare earths are somewhat of a misnomer. They are not particularly scarce or rare in the Earth's crust.
So you find them in the ground?
Yes. Almost all materials you find in the ground. Like copper, like iron, you will mine, you will dig up ore, you will process or separate out the good material from the bad material. The reason why rare earths are called rare earths is because they're not concentrated the same way coal is concentrated, the same way copper or iron is concentrated. There are very few locations in the world where you find concentrations of these rare earths in excess of even a few percent. 30 years ago, the U.S. was the number one producer of rare earth materials in the world. There's a mine in Southern California right on the Nevada border called Mountain Pass Mine. And for many years, that was the world's leading producer. And then over the subsequent 30-some years, China entered the market, didn't pay quite as much attention to environmental concerns, didn't pay quite as much attention to worker safety, and took over the entire market. And by 2010, China had approximately 95 to 97% of the worldwide market for rare earths. And then, in 2010, they got into a spat with Japan over a fishing trawler, and overnight they imposed export quotas, and the prices of these rare earths went up by a factor of 10 or 20 or even 50.
So that was a wake-up call.
That was a wake-up call for the entire world. So imagine you are a producer of cell phones or fluorescent lamps, and all of a sudden your price for the raw materials has gone up by an order of magnitude. The world responded this crisis, to this rare earth, to this critical materials crisis.
So did this mean that all of a sudden the Ames Lab looked mighty good to the federal government?
Well, it did, actually. We always look good to the federal government. Got to make sure we say that. But yes.
And the U.S. government said, thank God we've got rare earth specialists in Ames, Iowa.
The European Union, Japan, Australia, many countries all got their wake-up call, their call to action, started developing long-term plans, which they probably should have had already. The U.S. had a funding call for a very large energy innovation hub, and this particular one was on critical materials. Ames Laboratory partners with a handful of other universities and many, many companies. We've created this Critical Materials Institute that focuses on rare earth materials, but also on other critical materials. There are three primary focus areas: diversifying supply, which is making more. Doesn't mean digging more out of the ground, but after you dig it out, can you separate out the good material from the other cost effectively? You can also make more by improving reuse and recycling. For example, 1 billion hard disk drives are discarded every year. And every hard disk drive has a couple of these tiny magnets in it that contain the rare earth materials, because those are the best magnets by far. So if there are ways to cost effectively either extract and reuse or extract and recycle those magnets, you've just had a big impact on the supply, because you don't have to dig as much out of the ground or you don't have to rely on China as much. So that's the way you make more. You either diversify supply or you improve reuse and recycling. Mm-hmm. The way you use less is to develop substitutes. And here, for example, we can talk about either magnets or fluorescent lighting. With magnets, if the scientific community can come up with magnets that use either less rare earths or no rare earths, you've taken the pressure off that supply. The fluorescent lamps you have here, each of them contains some of the rarer of the rare earths. Europium creates a red phosphor, and terbium creates both green and blue. We are working with one of our partners, GE Lighting, in order to develop substitutes that use no rare earths or less rare earths. And Vitaly, if you'd like to talk a little bit about that maybe, about the lighting.
Absolutely. It's really an important part. Lighting is one of the biggest users of energy. If you can make it more efficient, then again, it's a winning situation. You don't need to produce as much electricity anymore. And Critical Material Institute, it's part of its mission, actually, to diversify supplies and find substitutes. If you look at the rare earths, they are everywhere in nature. You can find them in many, many places. The problem is it's not economical to pull them out from earth and make products out of them. And one of the biggest problems with all of the rare earths is the fact that you cannot just get out what you need. You have to separate out everything else which is there, right, and stockpile it. And if you can't sell it, it's just a waste. So that's one of the biggest problems why the rare earths are so pricey. And people are using them because it's difficult to substitute them.
Do you have to dig deep to find these things?
It depends. But most of the rare earths mines are actually open pit mines, right? You just open up the earth and just scoop them up. What made Chinese so successful in taking the market, they actually have piles of soil. You can pour some liquid over them, and you just collect the solution, and that's your mining process. You basically leach out, which is very inexpensive. Mm-hmm. The questions about environment are, of course, aside, but that's what actually made them so successful.
Mm-hmm. Now, your area of expertise includes environmental concerns.
Yes and no. My research interests do involve technologies to improve efficiency of technologies like refrigeration, for example.
Can you explain that a little bit?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we all use refrigerators, air conditioners, freezers, etc. And one of the big research projects that AmesLab was able to bring in is called Caloric Cool, where we look into developing solid materials with efficiency that is about a third better than you can do today. Just think about it. Typical cost to run air conditioner in Iowa would be on the order of $1,000 a year for a house, right? So if you can do the same thing, paying only $700 a year, that's a win-win situation, right? It's a technology that enables us to use electricity more efficient. Plus, if you think about what runs inside modern air conditioners, it's a chemical liquid which is volatile, and if for whatever reason there is a leak in a system, it all evaporates and goes up into the atmosphere. And these chemicals actually go up in the air, and they destroy the ozone layer that protects the Earth from cosmic rays. And if you have a system which provides refrigeration without a danger of this volatile liquid escaping in the atmosphere, that's already a substantial step forward in terms of, you know, making lives better down the road. We need to make sure that our kids breathe fresh air.
Absolutely.
Enjoy the sun without a danger of being burned and, you know, all the other stuff. I'm actually convinced that this technology has a very bright future. It's called caloric cooling.
Caloric cooling.
That's right.
This is a lot of what Ames Laboratory does. We work on materials to convert energy from one form into a usable type. What I'm really excited about is that air conditioning and refrigeration use up approximately 25% of the U.S. electrical energy budget. And that is a huge, huge, huge mm-hmm. number. And the materials that Vitaly and his team are working on have the potential to totally revolutionize refrigeration and air conditioning the same way the lighting industry has undergone this remarkable transformation over just the last few years. The lighting industry used incandescent bulbs for a century. Just in the last decade, however, LED lights are beginning to take over and will totally dominate the market mm-hmm. relatively soon. And why is that? They are much more energy efficient. They last much, much longer. Costs are coming down. Mm-hmm. So the lighting industry has undergone this remarkable transformation that is improving energy efficiency across the world. And our goal is to do the same with refrigeration and air conditioning. Mm-hmm. If Vitaly and his team can come up with low-cost, earth-abundant materials that convert one form of energy into another, it would be relatively straightforward to put that into a refrigeration or an air conditioning system and mm-hmm. making that commercially available to the world.
For which we're not dependent on China.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So how many years' investment is such a project?
Well, to put this in perspective, I started working on caloric materials just about 20 years ago. And I think over the course of 20 years, we were able to build the strong case that this is something worth looking into. Following our initial research here, which is done here in Ames, the research on caloric materials and caloric refrigeration took off all over the world. 20 years ago, it was literally a few papers a year that mentioned caloric cooling. Today, it's several papers a day that are being published out by different people describing different things that are doing in terms of material systems, etc. So it's not a fast process, but what is really exciting, we are close to really the stretch where we can pick up speed and make sure the technology takes off.
These projects are long-term time investments.
Absolutely.
So they require a certain visionary approach because you have to project what is meaningful for the future. Does the science lead you to that understanding, or where does that vision come from?
Well, it's a mix of things. It's first and foremost basic science, which is curiosity-driven research, right? You have to have the mindset, the people who are willing to do the research and the tools. And that needs to all come together. Unfortunately, everything that has been easy has been done already. I mean, we're in the times that to really make a difference, you really have to work hard. And I think what is best about Ames and Iowa State, we have very nice people in the Ames Laboratory who are dedicated, who are willing to take risks, and that's an important part. I mean, you do take risks in science. They may not be life-threatening things, right? But you do have to take risks when you venture into something which is not known. And that's what we do best, I guess. We actually open up new avenues, new pathways for research, and really research which can make a difference in the lives of not just Iowa, but the country.
So you're saying today at 70 years old, it's a strong team?
Oh, absolutely. It's probably the best it has been. I'm not trying to offend anybody. I think it took 70 years, actually, to build one of the best teams in the nation, despite being the small size.
It is truly a very exciting time to be at Ames Laboratory now. Historically, it's taken, on average, 20 years to take any concept and get that into commercial use. That seems to be about average. You have to have the basic research foundation in order to come up with creative new ideas, where someone identifies a need, and then the whole community generally jumps on that problem and tries to solve it.
I just have to ask this because there's so much pressure right now for alternate sources of energy to replace oil. Where is that research happening?
That is a priority at Iowa State. It's a priority at many of the national laboratories, many universities, not only in the U.S., but throughout the world. Batteries and energy storage is a huge research endeavor because coming up with ways to store energy at the grid scale, for example, wind or hydro at the grid scale, that would have a huge impact. Iowa State has an excellent program in batteries and energy storage led by Professor Steve Martin. They have excellent work on wind energy. That research is being done here. It's being done throughout the country at national labs and universities, everywhere. But another example from Ames Laboratory which demonstrates global impact is with lead solder. So for a century, the world used lead tin in the solder for everything from plumbing, which is a bad idea, to electronics. So 20 years ago, all electronics used lead tin solder. Europe basically said, we want to get lead out of all the electronics industry. They basically kicked off a challenge to the world that said, come up with a lead-free solder. And scientists around the world started working on that. And Ivar Andersen, one of Ames Laboratory's greatest inventors ever, in fact, he was just inducted into the National Inventors Hall of Fame, he and his team developed the first lead-free solder. And that lead-free solder was initially licensed to a company in eastern Iowa and then went on to be licensed in 65 different countries. It is the worldwide lead-free solder of choice. It was able to get lead out of the environment, so the electronics industry workers are not exposed to that lead. There's not issues with lead getting into the landfills and being leached out into the water. A tremendous impact that has had only positive influence on the world. The basic science foundation was there, and then someone identified the need, and out came the product.
When these projects are completed, do they result in patents?
Many times, yes. Lead-free solder is the number one royalty producer all time in Iowa State University history. It is the second all-time royalty producer for the Department of Energy. It's garnered more than $65 million for the university, which is split between the university, Ames Laboratory, and the research team.
The royalties go to Iowa State.
And Ames Laboratory and the inventor. And we use those funds along with a very generous Iowa State University contribution to purchase those very sensitive instruments that went into our new building.
So the Ames Lab is an enterprise as well as a research center.
I wouldn't go that far.
You wouldn't? How many patents does Ames Lab have?
On the order of 500, quite a bit, I guess.
Yeah.
And about how much income comes from patents to the Ames Lab?
It is very nonlinear. Lead-free solder patent generated a huge amount. Most patents never generate any money at all. Although it is in Ames Laboratory's best interest to have lots of patents and lots of licenses, because that allows us to fund the startups, gives us a little more free energy and flexibility. That is not our primary function. Our primary function is to do the research, create new materials, and enable inventions like this.
Do you have businesses like GE coming to you and asking you to initiate a project, or are the projects initiated only by the Ames Lab?
It's both. It's primarily we form collaborations and form teams, and then jointly we seek funding from the federal government. On the other hand, there are cases where large companies, even small companies, know what Ames Laboratory does, and they will come to us and they say, hey, we're interested in this. And in that case, we will form either a cooperative research agreement or just a project where we work with them, where they fund us to work on some specific problem that they have.
So you could potentially get a grant from a business like GE as well as the federal government.
Absolutely.
Do they ever come to you with projects that you don't feel are worthy of research?
Yes.
So you're juggling numerous revenue sources to support the Ames Lab.
It's mainly Department of Energy.
Mainly Department of Energy.
And some of these cooperative agreements that we have with companies. Those are the main two sources. The ideas are almost always generated from the scientists. And then leadership helps find avenues to get those things funded.
Without the Department of Energy, Ames Lab would not have existed the way it is.
Currently, we are in excess of 90% funding through the Department of Energy.
Is there concern at the Ames Lab about cuts in the Department of Energy? Or have you been told not to speak to the public like the Department of the Environment, the EPA?
We are worried about the funding. The president's budget came in with significant cuts to many, many of the agencies. And if those cuts make it through Congress, we will have to adjust and adapt. It will have an impact on our research. It may have an impact on our workforce. But we won't know until we actually get our final budgets.
But you're not experiencing the kind of pressure the EPA and the Department of Agriculture experienced?
No.
I mean, obviously, you're here talking to me, so you haven't been told not to speak to the public.
No, not at all, actually.
No.
We have a great story to tell. Our research is truly world-class. We are having an impact both within Iowa, within the country, and globally. Our budgets are never quite what we want them to be, but they're moving in the right direction for now. There's no doubt that we are incredibly well-respected in the scientific community. Congress feels very positive about the national laboratories in general. We've been called the crown jewels of American science. These laboratories have had amazing impacts throughout their history, and we expect to continue doing that. The expectation of the country is that we continue doing that.
I'm Ursula Rudenberg. We're speaking about the Ames Lab, which is celebrating its 70th anniversary this week. And I'm speaking with Adam Schwartz, director of the Ames Lab, and Vitaly Pacharsky, who's a scientist at the Ames Lab. And he's been telling us a little bit about his research. A lot of it's focused on technical improvement to the refrigeration. Mr. Pacharsky, did you come to Iowa State because of the Ames Lab?
Yes. I came to Ames Lab first time in 1989.
From where?
From former Soviet Union. I was born in Ukraine. At that time, United States and Soviet Union had scientific exchange. Soviet Union would pick up about 30 scientists to visit different labs in the United States, and United States would pick up about 30 scientists to visit different labs in the Soviet Union and work there for about a year. The reason I picked Ames was actually because of rare earths.
Because of rare earths science,
yes. Mm-hmm. I stayed 10 months, and after that I had an offer to stay. And I said, well, I'd love to stay, but I can't. But in the future, I would love to come back. And it actually happened in 93. And I've been here ever since.
And you're a professor at Iowa State now, too.
Yes, that is correct.
But you came because of the Ames Lab.
That is true. I was really interested in expanding my research and in looking what else could be done, and Ames was really the right place.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Schwartz, how did you end up the director of the Ames Lab?
I'm actually coming up on my own anniversary. I will have been here 3 years at the end of this month, and I spent nearly 23 years at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California.
Are you a scientist yourself?
I'm also a scientist. I'm also a faculty member, professor of material science and engineering within the College of Engineering, although at this point I am not teaching. Someday I'd still like to do that. But the reason why I came to Ames is because I was part of this team that was developing Critical Materials Energy Innovation Hub proposal. And when the team led by Ames won, one of the requirements was that the director of the laboratory, Alex King, had to step down as director of the laboratory to become director of this Critical Materials Institute. So they were looking for a new director, and now I'm here. So
and again, we have Adam here just because of the Ames Laboratory.
We've just scratched the surface when it comes to the activity, but it's a lot to absorb. We've talked a little bit about the history of the lab, how it started with Professor Spedding, and I learned about F electrons.
Mm-hmm.
And have a little bit of a sense for the first time what a rare earth metal is.
Yes. What we are known worldwide for is our ability to synthesize materials that virtually no one else can synthesize. So we have created numerous materials, whether they are new catalysts, new types of catalysts that no one has ever made before, or new superconductor materials, or new metamaterials, virtually a new class of materials that has remarkable optical properties. These are the exciting things that Ames Laboratory does that virtually no one else can do. We seek to understand the physics and the chemistry of why these materials behave the way they do. And then we go off and try and optimize that. So we really try to accelerate discovery of new materials that are going to have an impact for U.S. energy security and worldwide energy security. It's a very exciting time to be in science in general. It's an extremely exciting time to be involved in research and materials because the fundamental base is to the point where, like Vitaly said, all the easy stuff has been done.
Oh, it's been done already.
So much of the research is at the intersection of physics and chemistry and biology. And in many cases, this is open space. Building communities, building teams, it's fun.
Yeah, and it never stops, right?
It never stops.
What Ames Lab does best, it's not just we create new materials, we also share them. Science is only science if it's reproducible.
Well, you mentioned earlier that there's several findings a day published about refrigeration.
It's about caloric materials, correct.
Is that a good thing or is that
it's
competition?
It definitely is a good thing. No scientist can work in a vacuum. Scientists are only as appreciated as other people notice what they're doing. And I'm glad to say that Ames Laboratory does really well in that. I mean, if you look at simple things like citations, because our output is publications. Patents, publications, and if it's important, if people, other people see value in it, they will refer to your work and they will build up on your work. So it is really a very good thing.
You're not worried about somebody else getting the patent before the Ames Lab does?
We are careful about this. We have an office which actually oversees this process. They get all of the manuscripts when they are submitted. They review them. And if, for example, I missed something that could potentially be patented, they will call me back and say, wait a second, just file a patent on that. So we have a process in place.
So you cover yourself.
Because as a scientist, I may miss things. Mm-hmm. It may not be obvious to me, but it may be obvious to somebody else that it has potentially commercial.
We would prefer to be the first to come up with this revolutionary material that's going to have an impact. But if our research is providing some of the fundamental knowledge and building up the community's knowledge of it, and someone else somewhere else in the world comes up with a material that's going to have an impact that was based on the research we did, we're still doing a really good job. So yes, we want to be the one who develops it, but we want to drive the overall community and the world to better refrigeration and cooling technologies sooner rather than later or never.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You're saying that the research value, the knowledge value is still higher for the Ames Lab than the commercial value.
Yes. The commercial value is a bonus. That is not why we are here. That's not part of our mission. Our mission statement is Ames Laboratory creates materials, inspires minds to solve problems, and addresses global challenges. And we believe that strongly. So if we are creating new materials, if we're inspiring minds, if we are addressing global challenges, and someone else gets that final material that has the huge impact, we still did fantastic work.
Credit yourself for contributing.
Absolutely.
Final question. How are you going to celebrate the 70th anniversary?
Well, this whole week we are celebrating. We started with giving out donuts to all Ames Laboratory staff as they came in very, very early in the day. I give the annual State of the Laboratory address, and we have our annual anniversary barbecue. It's going to be lots of activities and lots of fun. And something truly to celebrate 70 years is remarkable.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us and letting us speak to Central Iowa.
Yeah.
Happy birthday.
Thank you very much. It's really been great to be here. We are very proud of what the Ames Laboratory has done in the 70 years that we've been here. And we are even more excited about hopefully the 70 years to come. We have a lot of materials to discover, to accelerate that discovery and get them out and with useful applications.
What do you think you're going to be doing 70 years from now?
In 70 years from now, we are all going to have refrigerators based on caloric materials.
Solid state.
Greenhouse gas vapor compression technology will be something that they only study in long ago textbooks.
Yeah, look, what else can you do? What good can come out of it.
Right. It is really hard to predict. There will always be materials problems, whether
it's
for energy or for the environment or for clothing, vehicle, you name it. I think Ames Laboratory will be doing fundamental and applied science, tackling some of the world's biggest issues every year.
Well, what is inevitable? We will change, of course.
We will change.
We just don't know how we will change.
Well, thank you so much.
Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
Adam Schwartz, the director of the Ames Lab, and Vitaly Pacharsky, a scientist and researcher at Ames Lab. I'm your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg.
Crystal clear ocean to ride on the crest of a wild raging storm, to work in the service of life and the living in search of the answers to questions unknown, to be part of the movement, part of the growing, part of beginning to understand. So the places you've been to, the things that you've shown us, the stories you tell. I could, so I sing to your spirit, the men who have served you so long and so well. I am. Oh, love. I am. Oh, love. Like the dolphin who guides you, you bring us beside you, light up the darkness and show us the way. For though we are strangers in your silent world, to live on the land we must learn from the sea. To be true as the tide, free as a windswell, joyful and loving in letting it be. I could explore the places you've been to, the things that you've shown us, the stories you tell.
John Denver with Calypso. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg, and I am here with Alex Fafar from the Ames History Center, who's joined me in the studio. Alex, welcome. It's great to have you back here at KHOI.
Thank you, Ursula. Appreciate you having me here again.
So you're here to talk about downtown buildings and a lecture that's coming up.
Yeah, we'll just get the date, the numbers out of the way here. On Tuesday, May 23rd at 7 p.m. at the Ames Public Library, we'll be having the third of our four lecture series, our annual lecture series, and that'll be Main Street Building Secrets with Sharon Wirth and Judy Gilger. So perhaps many of you have walked around downtown, and whether you knew it or not, there's a new plaque project we had going on last year. And so there's these nice little black plaques scattered throughout various Main Street and Fifth Street businesses.
So buildings that were historic were able to apply to you to get a plaque.
Yes.
Saying that they were, and we missed the deadline for the Ames Pantorium, much to our chagrin.
Chagrin, yes. Yes, there
is. But there are a relative number of buildings around here that do have plaques now on from that project.
Yes, there are. I wish I had the number of the total ones on me. I'm sorry, I don't. But yeah, this is done through the Historic Preservation Commission, and they were able to get a grant to cover a lot of the startup money to get that. So some people that got their name in really early got some plaques, and then we kind of got a little bit more money for a few others. And so we're working on still possibly adding more in the future here. So I think there's still a list they're working on.
Yeah, well, tell us a little bit about the buildings that do have plaques. Do you have a few stories to share?
Yeah, we got a little bit. So a lot of our kind of start down here on the Douglas corner, just about right where we are here. But you go down Main Street and you look at the buildings like the Kitchen Design Store on the corner of Douglas. A lot of these buildings are like 1890s, roughly. Ames had two pretty serious fires in the 1880s, mm-hmm. Mainly because we had wood structure buildings all built right next to each other. And so after the final fire.
Yeah, and that accounts for the fact that a lot of times when you look at older photographs of Ames, it looks more urban than it does now because
yes.
A lot of the buildings had two floors, and so it was a much kind of a higher city outline.
A little bit, yeah. We've lost a couple second stories on a few buildings on Main Street for sure, most notably the Ames Stationers, mm-hmm. if you're familiar with that. Now the Quilting Connection building, yeah, 1987, we lost a roof on that one. And also the Everett's, they're celebrating anniversary this month, I believe. And their building, too, they took off. That used to be, I believe, the Montgomery Ward Farm Store, and that had a second story. And they had taken that off at 1.2 and just made it a single story. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, a few little things changing like that, especially near, like, the corner of Duff. We used to have, like, a nice three-story hotel with, like, a turret on the corner. That's kind of where Scott Richardson
Insurance company.
Yeah, State Farm, I believe.
Farm,
yes.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Right where that is. So that definitely had a different feel when you turned on to Main Street there at the Duff intersection. But, yeah, you look at that 100 block and the 200 block, quite a number of those buildings are from the 1890s. So we look at that Kitchen Design Store was originally not the Story County Bank, the Union National Bank, and then kind of the tan building just south of the radio station here, that was the Story County Bank. And those are kind of competitors back in the 1890s. And those are kind of like two of our kind of staples here down right away. It's a really iconic corner looking up the street. And that's a lot of reason these buildings were built down on this end of Main Street is because our original depot, not the one that we have today, but we had a wood depot that's roughly right around where Dutch Oven Bakery is today. And so, naturally, you wouldn't want to walk four blocks to a hotel when you could just walk one block. So they really concentrated on the 100 and 200 blocks.
And Dutch Oven is located?
It's on Duff Avenue, just south of Main Street, right by the tracks, naturally,
yeah.
right where the railroad would have gone there. And so you can kind of, as you do this plaque tour, just as a tour, we have brochures that have all the plaques at the Ames Historical Society for free. So you can stop by and pick up one of those. But as you kind of make your way down Main Street, you can feel it growing towards that new depot, the one we have that was redeveloped by Hubbell in the 90s. That one was built in 1900. So as the century turns, you start to see buildings get into the very end of the 200 block, and the 300 blocks and 400 blocks are really starting to develop in the teens, the aughts and the teens right after that. So you can kind of follow that progression and see Main Street keep moving towards that depot. But, you know, if you look, if you get near the Hy-Vee drugstore corner, you notice that Ames Locksmith House. You need to imagine back in 1900 that the 300 and 400 blocks were all houses pretty primarily. And so it's not until the late teens and the 20s that they start to either a lot of the houses they just pick up and move to other places of town, and some, you know, get demoed or used for other various things, repurposed.
That house, I think I remember being Tony's Little Italy.
Is it? Oh, I don't know that much about that building. That's one I haven't looked into. It didn't get a plaque, obviously.
It was an Italian restaurant.
Oh, no kidding. It's like funny, all those things. You have dentist office, Italian restaurants and houses on Main Street. What else could you ask for, right?
And a Greek restaurant with the Franco brothers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Which is right here by Douglas on Main Street.
Yes.
So if somebody wants to see the plaques themselves, obviously they can take a brochure from the Ames History Center.
Yes.
That tells them where to look.
Yep. And you can pick those up at 416 Douglas. We're at the corner of 5th and Douglas, right by the Ames Public Library, and the KHOI radio station, right between the two. And they're for free to pick up. So it's just a little brochure, and it has a map to tell you which way, because they're not – although most of them are on Main Street, they did expand out into 5th Street, because there's still a lot of great buildings out there. And so, like, some of the Main Street ones might be a little bit older, from the 1890s, but there's a few newer ones on there. We'll call new in history terms, like Ames City Hall. Was built in 1937 as Ames High School. If you haven't lived in town for very long, you might not realize that. But if you spend about 5 minutes walking around, you start to see the lockers and all the remnants from the high school laying in there. So there's a few newer buildings like that, and also the building on Fifth Street, which is today Mars Wealth Management. That was originally the McFarland Clinic.
That's right.
And so a lot
Isn't
of people probably remember going there before they expanded up by the hospital there. So that's
right. The whole McFarland Clinic was in that building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you can believe it or not.
Which is the building next to where the Ames Tribune is.
Yes,
now.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Right. Yep. Right next to. In fact, the Ames Tribune was in that building, I believe, just prior to Mars Wealth Management going in there, and they recently did a very nice project of updating that facade and getting it right back to what it looked like in the 40s when that was built. So that's one of the older ones, kind of on there, but. Back in the 40s, even, we have some shots of people getting in line for polio vaccines. So it's like Ames images that really show what was going on nationally, too, and really make it a little bit more relevant.
Now, Sharon Wirth and Judy Gilger will be giving the lecture, and they are experts on architecture, as I recall. So the lecture will really be informative about that aspect of project.
That was one thing they really focused on the plaques was the architecture. So you'll get a lot if they were able to find the builder and the architect. That kind of information is included in there. And then also, information about the design, which is really good because some of those – on the plaques, they put a little picture that shows some of, like, brickwork and things like that. Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of the buildings have been refacaded back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, whenever they were able to do it. It was pretty popular to take off the what we call, like, the Victorian features, all that nice, little things on top of the building. And a lot of them just got really bricked up, square, and pretty plain after that. So it was
straightforward Midwestern look.
Exactly. Right. And that's what people wanted. They wanted a nice, sleek, modern Main Street, which is now we go back and want what we got rid of. So they were able to include some of that information, too, so that you could see what this building did really look like. Mm-hmm. I think we were in the other week and we were talking about London Underground, and
that's
got a really old facade. And London Underground and the building just to the west, I can't remember what business is in there, but those used to be matching facades, and now they are nowhere near that at all. So that's kind of a cool contrast you can get from what we used to have to what they kind of changed Main Street to look like in the 40s and 50s.
Okay, well, thank you. This is Alex Fafar from the Ames History Center. Tell the time and place again for the lecture about these buildings.
That'll be on Tuesday, May 23rd at 7 p.m. at the Ames Public Library in the Farwell Brown Auditorium. And be sure to, if you, before the lecture, after the lecture, come down, get a brochure if you want to come down and do that Main Street plaque tour, because it's pretty interesting on that.
Your website for the Ames History Center?
That's ameshistory.org. And we're also located at 416 Douglas, open Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 4. And actually, starting today and tomorrow we have a book sale going on. So if you want to come down and get some cheap books, come down and take a look through our collection. Not our collection, but ones that we've gotten donated to us and that we're selling to help benefit the Historical Society.
Okay. Book sale at the Ames History Center, which is on Douglas Avenue right next to the Ames Pantorium. And the address?
416 Douglas.
And 416 we're on the Douglas.
First floor.
And you've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Ursula Rudenberg. Earlier in the show, we heard from Adam Schwartz, director of the Ames Lab and scientific researcher, and ISU professor Vitaly Pacharsky, and they were celebrating the 70th anniversary of the Ames Lab by sharing some of its history and current research projects, as well as the spirit and vision of the team there. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here at KHOI at 89.1 FM. And remember that you can also hear it streaming live at khoifm.org and also hear it archived and find links to the guests and information you've heard on the program. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kay Shelley. We also heard Calypso by John Denver. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a radio show, so if you would like to try to your hand at reporting, we'll train you. And remember that you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
Funding for KHOI is made possible in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. In the heart of Ames, the Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun. Located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza, the Farmers Market provides fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment every Saturday.